This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. As anyone who's gone through the process of choosing a college knows, it can be an overwhelming experience. Many families look to college rankings for guidance. U.S. News and World Report released its 2016 version of the best colleges and universities last week. But while popular, the rankings have generated controversy. In the past, some universities have manipulated data to climb higher on the list. There's also an updated version of the Federal College Scorecard. It was supposed to rate colleges, but that idea was scrapped after blowback from the higher education community and Democrats and Republicans. So, what does the scorecard offer, and how can families best wade through all of the information out there? Joining us this hour are Michael Stratford. He covers federal policy for Inside Higher Ed. Welcome, Michael.
Good morning.
And Goldie Blumenstick is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education and author of American Higher Education in Crisis, What Everyone Needs to Know. Hi, Goldie.
Good morning. How are you?
Good morning. Let's begin with U.S. News and World Report and its 2016 rankings. No surprise, perhaps, Princeton, Harvard, and Yale are 1, 2, 3. But critics say the publication's ranking formula is questionable, and there's the perception that public universities often get short shrift. Goldie, could you get into that for us?
Yeah, that's true. They do make that complaint. And frankly, if you look at that list, there's, every year colleges will make an announcement about how they've moved up two or three rungs in the rankings, but maybe they've fallen two or three rungs in the rankings, and they don't tend to announce that as often. The rankings don't change all that much. I think if you go back and look over time, the same 100 schools that have been in the rank at the top level of the U.S. News rankings have been there since the U.S. News started these in the mid-'80s.
So what do the rankings look at?
Well, those rankings, they're often very much criticized because they tend to emphasize inputs. Schools with more resources tend to do better in the rankings. That's one of the reasons private colleges, particularly the sort of the more elite ones, tend to do the best in those rankings. And they tend to have smaller classes as a result of having more resources. And so again, that kind of puts them up higher in the rankings. They have larger endowments. Again, that puts them up higher in the rankings. So it's sort of an input-driven system that doesn't really tell you. Frankly, none of these rankings tell you very much about what the education is at the institution. It more tells you about the resources of the college.
And that was my next question. What do they leave out? Any specifics?
You know, they leave out the most important thing that happens at a college. What are students learning? And that's actually not completely the ranking's fault, because it's very hard to – that's not an easy metric, right? How do you measure student learning?
Sure.
The fact is colleges – I've been writing about colleges for now 25-plus years, and colleges have always been sort of resistant to the notion that you can measure this stuff. And so instead what they've gotten are these other kinds of rankings. Now the government's doing it, but, rankings that look at inputs, rankings that talk about salaries now and graduation rates, and nothing really about the real education that goes on at schools. It's a much harder thing to measure, but I've spoken to education researchers who say it's not impossible to do it, and probably colleges should be doing a lot more of that.
So, Michael Stratford, in your opinion, what should students and families take from a ranking system, if anything?
Well, the goal of the Obama administration scorecard is to focus students' attention and students and families' attention on outcomes, what students earn after they leave a college, whether they're able to successfully repay their loans, whether after attending a college they end up with a credential on the other side. So the Obama administration has been one of the most vocal critics of the ranking system that Goldie was talking about. They argue that it favors selective institutions and privileges institutions that reject large shares of students rather than focusing on student outcomes, which is the goal of what the data that they're now putting out.
Well, President Obama had originally envisioned for the college scorecard that there would be a rating of colleges so that families could choose institutions that would provide good value, correct? What happened there, Michael?
Right, and the administration was always clear that what they wanted to do with that was to rate colleges, to provide a government rating of colleges, that a college is performing good, bad, or somewhere in the middle, as opposed to a numerical ranking. But nonetheless, after some some pretty severe pushback from colleges and universities and other higher education observers. They abandoned the plan earlier this summer and said, frankly, that their data wasn't good enough to draw those type of comparative judgments between a college's metrics. Instead, they sort of did this data dump and are putting out information that they hope students and families will use to make their own decisions. But also, you know, they're putting out thousands of new data points that the federal government hasn't released before, and and hoping that journalists and other education researchers and policymakers are going to pore over that data and sort of slice and dice the new data to make different and new observations about how students are performing at colleges.
Okay, let's parse a little bit of that data dump, if you will. This version of the scorecard, as you mentioned a moment ago, does offer insight into the earnings of people who've graduated or left college. How does that work, Michael?
Right. So the salary data is compiled from the federal government looking at who gets federal loans and who gets federal grants, and then tying that information to data that the IRS collects on tax forms. And so the salary metrics, and this is a criticism that colleges and universities are quick to point out, capture only the salaries of students who attended a college and received federal financial aid. And colleges would point out that leaves out a share of many students at some institutions. And so the salary metric captures students only with federal financial aid. It looks 6 years after they start college whether they are earning more than $25,000 a year, which is the average salary of just a high school graduate. So at 6 years out, they're looking just at the share of students earning more than a high school graduate. And then at 10 years out, or 10 years after starting college, the administration has now put out the median salary of a student who attended a specific institution.
I'd like to get into how former students are doing, but Goldie, first, what is your take on just using students who have won Pell Grants or federal loans? Are the critics correct?
Well, it does leave out roughly about 30% of the students at colleges right now, and probably it leaves out the more affluent students on the whole. The education department officials said that they didn't think the statistics were that different. I'm not exactly sure how they know that. Maybe they have access to some other data that they don't have ability to publish, but they said that they thought the earnings data would be roughly the same even if they included those other students. You know, one thing that's interesting about those numbers, it is a data dump. Michael's absolutely right about that, and we're still, you know, diving into it here. But one of the things that was sort of striking about this right off the top is at more than half of the colleges, more than half of the alumni hadn't earned more than a high school graduate after 6 years.
Goldie Blumenstein.
6 years after they started.
So 6 years after they started, they're not earning more than a person who might not have gone on to college, you're saying.
Right. So more than half the colleges.
Yeah. More than half the colleges. So Goldie Blumenstein, what does this tell us?
I think of all the numbers that I've seen coming out of this scorecard, that seems to be the one that's going to be the hardest one for the colleges to explain. Well, I guess it depends. If you are the kind of person who thinks a college is only designed to help you get a job and help you get ahead, well, then that's a number that you should be looking at very carefully. If you think college is about more than that, then that's a sort of a different set of number. Then you might want to look at that number differently. The fact is, colleges for the last, 20 years or so have been saying you should go to college because if you don't, you're not going to do as well in the economy as someone who just has a high school degree. This scorecard kind of points out a lot of colleges where that's not the case.
Michael,
you might go to college, and not end up earning more than a high school grad.
And Michael Stratford, what is your take on that?
Well, one other thing that's worth pointing out is that the earnings data that the administration is putting out right now is by institution. So an entire university is getting one number, the median across all of their students. And in some cases, that's just really not a very useful metric for students who are selecting specific majors and specific programs. The department says it's working on getting programmatic, program-level earnings data. So, for instance, right now, the data show at a university, it doesn't separate the earnings after college of a sociology major versus a computer science and engineering data. And there's a big gap at some institutions between those programs.
So it sounds like this would be tough for families to navigate.
Yeah, it looks pretty simple when you call it up, but you have to really, and each number, there's like a little eye underneath it for more information, and the deeper you go into the eye, the more you realize that there's a lot of nuance behind the numbers, that it's all very important.
Michael Stratford, if I'm reading some of these numbers correctly, of those who've graduated or left names like Bennington College in Vermont, nearly half weren't earning $25,000 after 10 years. That's Bennington. At Bard College, the average was about $37,000 that former students were earning. Are you surprised with those figures?
You know, this is the first time the government is producing this type of earnings data, so it's hard to have a baseline on which to compare it to. But to Goldie's point, I think colleges, especially those that market themselves as leading to high-paying or good-paying jobs, are going to be hard-pressed to sort of explain or spin those numbers.
And Goldie Blumenstick, there. Oh, go ahead. Did you have a point?
I was going to say, the other issue with these numbers right now, those, I think we also have to realize that the classes that this rating system covers right now are the students who've entered the economy kind of at really probably one of the worst times, right? This year the economy is really showing signs of a stronger recovery, but I think in the last two or three years when these students have graduated college, they've been in a pretty tough job market. Mm-hmm. So I guess I wonder in two or three years what this scorecard will look like in terms of those earnings. Will the students be rebounding into a better economy and getting higher paid jobs when they graduate?
So again, then, with the family that is looking at this website, what sort of attitude do they bring to it when they are navigating the website? How much weight do they put to the information that they are gathering, Goldie?
I think most experts who look at colleges, not just the colleges themselves, but anyone who advises students, high school counselors and the like, I think they would tell students to look at those salary numbers with a lot of caution, because even though that you don't want to go to college and come out, you know, really be so much in debt that you cannot manage, to just pick a college based on that number would be probably a very big mistake for a lot of students. There's a lot more that goes into picking a college than just what's this average salary number coming out of it that, as Michael pointed out, doesn't really necessarily tell you that much. I mean, is the college going to be a good fit? Are you going to meet your professors? Are you going to have good internship opportunities? There's
and
so
Goldie,
many other things that go into it.
I've got to stop you there. We're up against a break, but we'll have more in a moment here on Radio Times. We're taking a look at some of the tools students and families use to help choose a college. If you'd like to join the conversation, 888-477-9499. More of Radio Times coming right up. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. Michael Stratford covers federal policy for Inside Higher Ed, and Goldie Blumenstick is a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education, and they are with us for the next 20 minutes or so as we look at college ranking systems and the Federal College Scorecard site. Lines are open at 888-477-9499. Our email address is radiotimes@whyy.org, or tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. I wanted to get into the fact that apparently there is a real gender gap in earnings for those who've graduated from some of the top institutions in the country. MIT's gap appears to be the largest. Men who've graduated MIT tend to make, on average, about $58,000 more than their female counterparts. And at Princeton, the average difference in pay was $47,000. Michael Stratford, you might think that the high-end diploma would lead to more equality in the workplace, but I guess the answer is not necessarily.
Yeah, that's certainly an interesting finding in the data, and one other aspect of this is that the administration is releasing on the scorecard, sort of the public facing website, sort of the top line numbers, but in the large data files that underlie the scorecard are these salary information and student debt information broken down by subgroups, by income brackets, by racial groups, by gender and other important subgroups. So it will be interesting to see as people sort of pore over this data, what other findings they come up with.
And Goldie Blumenstick, what is your take on these rather huge, large gaps?
I found it somewhat surprising, but maybe I shouldn't have. Maybe this scorecard is revealing the things that we already know. I mean, if that's the data for the 10 years out number, though, it raises the question of whether this includes some women who have stopped out at some point early in their careers. You know, some of the same issues came up when the Education Department unveiled the rule that it uses to regulate for-profit colleges. There were a lot of concerns about the data and about the gender biases in some of that data, that women were going into certain kinds of programs and then maybe stopping out, and some of those salaries weren't going to be reflected later on in the rule that, you know, and then those schools were going to be subjected to restrictions on their programs because students weren't earning that much relative to what they were borrowing. So some of the same issues came up in that. I think that's I don't know if that's a ratings issue or if that's an issue in our economy. Hmm.
Let's talk about the FAFSA, the Free Application for Federal Student Aid document. Many parents and students, suffice it to say, find it to be cumbersome, long, confusing. You have to fill it out every year, although the first year is the most challenging. And Goldie, you've written that by one estimate, almost a third of all undergraduates don't file the form, and a lot of them could have qualified for Pell Grants.
Yes, it's one of the biggest challenges out there in financial aid right now, to get students to file the FAFSA form and then to refile it once they've enrolled. There's often cases where students have enrolled in college, have attended for the first year, they don't realize they need to refile the form the second year, and then they lose out on their aid and they end up missing out on continuing college.
Why are so many not filing?
People don't, you would think the information would be clear, but some students just don't realize they need to refile it every year.
Or file
there's
in the
actually
place.
Been some people testing this message, testing this right now by sending out text messages to students to remind them, hey, you have to refile it every year. So what the government has just done is they've made it a little bit easier to file the FAFSA form by letting you use, like right now students are applying to college and they can now use their prior year's tax return to fill out FAFSA form. They don't have to wait until their families or they themselves file their taxes in January or February. And so they can actually apply and maybe get more information earlier from schools about what their financial aid might be.
And you can apply as early as October. But that doesn't apply to this crop of high school seniors, correct? That's next year?
Actually, I'm not certain about that.
Okay, we'll have to check into that.
Yeah.
Michael, education advocates are happy about the changes in the FAFSA, and the Education Department is supportive as well. But I understand there was some concern that this change in the FAFSA could cost the government some money. Are you familiar with that, Michael Stratford?
Yeah, that was sort of a point of contention. The push to make these changes to the FAFSA, advocates have been pushing for a long time, and that budgetary change, it was sort of the sticking point. The administration said earlier this year that they're interested in making these changes, but were concerned about the budgetary impact. And as I understand it, the budget impact is that making it easier to apply for aid means more students will apply for aid. So from the perspective of advocates who are pushing for this change, that's a good problem to have. Some members of Congress, some Republicans in Congress, even though they're supportive of the changes generally, sort of pointed at that cost and say that they want to be the ones to make the change and deal with the budget cost. But the Education Department says it's a relatively small amount. I think they said 1% of Pell Grant spending each year, which runs roughly in the high 30s, maybe $40 billion.
Okay, let's get to a comment from Rena. She says, looking at earnings from 6 to 10 years can be misleading. What about people who are in graduate school? Of course, their earnings would be lower than if they were working. Goldie Blumenstick, you want to address that?
She's right. that's exactly true. That's one of the issues with and those students who will eventually probably make a lot more money. So if you're looking at the six-year number, it's probably misleading. If you're looking at the 10-year number, though, it's a little less so because usually 10 years after you've started college. Let's say you've completed school in 4 or even 6 years. Maybe you've worked for a year or two, and then you've gone to graduate school for a year or two. Unless you've gone on to become a medical doctor or getting your PhD, you've probably completed your graduate degree at that point, and you're in the workforce. So the 10-year number probably does take into account graduate school. By the way, that 10-year number takes into account graduate school earnings, so it doesn't really reflect what you've earned out of, you know, you can't really give the credit to your college for those earnings.
Hmm. Goldie, you just wrote an article entitled, When a Degree is Just the Beginning. You go on to say that higher education is entering a new era, one in which some industry and non-academic certifications are more valuable than a degree. Could you explain that?
Yes, there are industry certifications out there right now, particularly in the IT fields, but also in obviously the energy, some of the energy fields, and some of the, and other industries, where if you get a particular certificate or a credential, and it's not even necessarily from a college, you can get a pretty good job right off the bat. It's one of the reasons these coding academies and coding boot camps are so popular right now. In many cases, there's our students who've gone to college and then are going back for a degree, but in some cases, they're not. Students can get, you know, jobs for, you know, $60,000, $70,000, $80,000 as coders and for companies. Students in the energy industry until very recently could get pretty good jobs working in the gas industry. Healthcare, there's also a few places in healthcare where that's the case as well.
And how is the higher education community reacting?
Well, they're just sort of getting their arms around this. I think community colleges in particular are starting to recognize this. I note in that article that there's some community colleges right now that are actually incorporating the industry certifications as part of their curriculum. So you'll get your community college degree, but along the way you'll also get perhaps 2 or 3 industry certifications. And then so when you graduate, you have your AA degree from the community college, and you have these certifications to get you a job. If you didn't happen to graduate right away, you still have these certifications from this college that get you started in the job market, and perhaps you'll come back and finish your degree later. Schools are just beginning to kind of recognize this, I think, as a new pathway into post-secondary education.
Michael Stratford, what's your take on the value of these certifications?
Well, another interesting part of this is the extent to which students attending these programs will be able to get access to federal aid. And the Education Department is working on an experiment that would open up some federal money for students to attend coding academies and other similar type programs. So not only is this something that is Goldie mentioned is that higher ed is sort of grappling with and trying to get their arms around, policymakers are also trying to figure out how to deal with the rise of these types of programs, both in whether federal aid goes to them and how to measure and evaluate the quality of the programs.
Okay, let's get to the phones. Edie in Westchester is standing by. Hello, Edie. Welcome to Radio Times.
Thank you so much. Good morning.
Good morning.
This is a subject that is near and dear to my heart. I have 2 wonderful daughters who, one just recently graduated, one's getting ready to graduate, and I wanted to comment on FAFSA. I absolutely agree. 4 or 5 years ago, it was very cumbersome. It's become less cumbersome. However, the greatest disappointment is when you get back the results, and it says your family can afford X amount of dollars. And what's really heartbreaking is that when you have a mortgage, you have car payments, there's no way. So really, in many ways, I think people, the third of the students you talked about, are probably just not bothering because it's like, why? It's not aid. It's a misnomer. It's a loan. Both my daughters, gratefully, are graduating from good private schools, but they've also borrowed. And they're both going to be in debt for many, many years.
Hmm.
The private loans are at 7% fixed rate, and it won't go any lower. And the federal loans, we're talking 4% and 6%. It's like, really?
Tough. It is. It's tough.
It's actually, and in our case, unfortunately, we couldn't save, and then my husband became gravely, gravely ill. And but on the upside, if you go to a private school, the endowments are amazing. And that's something everybody should look at.
I want to thank you for your call to Radio Times. Goldie Blumenstick, Edie's made a number of points. First of all, does FAFSA take into account some of these financial burdens that are only too real for families who are looking for financial aid?
It's supposed to, and many colleges also have a second form that they ask families to fill out in addition to the FAFSA. Typically, more so, the private colleges have this second form, which can ask for additional information and more extenuating circumstances. At the Chronicle today, we had a columnist write into us, an admissions director who's a very smart guy, and he pointed out the changes in this FAFSA might really change the power knowledge between the families and the colleges now. He thinks that having this form will actually give families a lot more information a lot sooner, being able to file the form sooner, will give them a lot more bargaining power with colleges, and will also really save families more from what he calls heartbreak, students who fall in love with colleges and only to find out later on that it's just not going to be practical for them. By being able to file this FAFSA form sooner and getting an answer sooner from the colleges, getting a sense sooner, people will be able to make a lot more realistic decisions in the process.
Let's make it harder
for the colleges.
Let's get to an email from John. And I'm not familiar with this phrase he uses, but how does university adoption of the corporate, quote, experience economy, end quote, figure into college recruitment and raising tuitions? Michael Stratford, you want to take a crack at that?
Oh, I have to admit, I'm not really sure what he means either.
Goldie Blumenstick?
I'll give it a try. I think he's sort of talking about the fact that colleges are, there are days when their admissions process feels a lot like a business. They have a class to fill. They want to do it with they want to spend the least amount of money as they can and get the class that will provide the most net tuition possible to the school. And perhaps that's what the caller's writing about. There's, admissions is it's a little bit of a financial game these days.
Let's toss accreditation into the mix. Michael Stratford, if you could, give us a quick refresher as to how the system works and its value to families.
So in order to receive federal aid and in most cases state aid, colleges need to be accredited. There are accrediting agencies that evaluate the quality of an institution. And it's also the way that the government sort of outsources its own quality review of institutions. And accreditation has many, many critics, at least the current system of it does, including this administration. And in rolling out the data, they've pointed out that they'd like to see accreditors do a better job of looking at student outcomes. And I think one interesting part of having more data about colleges, especially some of these loan repayment rates, is for the public to see that an institution remains accredited and an accrediting agency has stamped a seal of approval on an institution, even though the student outcomes by these new measures aren't really what the public might expect is a good institution.
And Goldie Blumenstick.
So I think the data is going to put what is already a large amount of pressure on accreditation.
And Goldie Blumenstick, how do those groups providing accreditation view the trend toward alternate certifications?
They're puzzled by it a little bit, but I spoke to one accreditor from one of the bigger regional accrediting agencies, and she said, they really want to learn more about this. They want to understand it. They want to be part of the conversation. They claim not to be threatened by it so much so as they want to, be in the mix. They do think they have some expertise in evaluating educational programs, and they hope that they could add that expertise to the discussion, particularly if these programs are going to become eligible for federal financial aid at some point.
Back to the college scorecard for just a moment before we wrap up here. I wanted to delve into this a little bit more. There's also apparently information about former students who make progress in paying off their federal loans. I think we touched on that just a bit, within 3 years of graduating or dropping out. Are these former students making decent headway in general, Michael Stratford?
Well, the answer is in a lot of cases, no. I think a lot of the attention has been focused on the salary data. The repayment rate information, though, I think might even be more helpful to families. Even if you don't view college as or even if you don't sort of have a very utilitarian view of college as only to go to the college that will, where you'll get the highest salary afterwards, it seems like at a minimum you would want to go to college and be able to successfully repay your loans, regardless of what your salary is. And so in a lot of cases, some of these repayment rates, especially at for-profit colleges, at some nonprofit colleges as well, and some community colleges, are pretty bad. In some cases, there are students who, or colleges where over half of students who borrow federal loans aren't able to repay a single dollar of their principal balance more than 7 years after leaving the school.
Goldie Blumenstick, any thoughts as we wrap up?
Yeah, I think the repayment rate number is a very interesting number. I think colleges, for a long time, advocates for sort of more transparency about the student aid system have wanted more information about the repayment rate. They think it's a clear measure of students' abilities to handle themselves, because colleges have a way to manipulate the other measure that the government has been using. So I think this number is a good and important number for people to be looking at.
And Michael Stratford, we've got about 10 seconds left. Back to the federal college scorecard system. Do you anticipate further revision?
Yes. The administration says it plans to update the scorecard at some point in the future, to be determined, including that program-level earnings data that we were talking about earlier.
Michael Stratford covers federal policy for Inside Higher Ed. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
And Goldie Blumenstick, thank you so much as well. Goldie's a reporter for the Chronicle of Higher Education and author of American Higher Education in Crisis, What Everyone Needs to Know. Thanks, Goldie.
Thank you.
As Marty says, we're switching gears the remainder of the hour. Just who was Homo Naledi? We'll be chatting with Jamie Shreve of National Geographic Magazine coming right up. Stay with us. This is Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moskowain. The scientific world is buzzing with the recent announcement that a trove of bones discovered 2 years ago in a cave in South Africa might be the remains of one of mankind's earliest ancestors. Dubbed Homo Naledi, the bones were found in an area of South Africa some call the cradle of humankind. And joining us now to tell this story is Jamie Shreve, National Geographic Magazine's executive editor of science and author of the October issue cover story entitled Mystery Man. Jamie Shreve, welcome to Radio Times.
Good morning. Glad to be here.
Yeah, glad to have you here. So take us back to 2013 when two explorers, Stephen Tucker and Rick Hunter, are making their way through a cave not far from Johannesburg, and the cave was called Rising Star. Why were they there?
Well, Rising Star is a very well-explored cave system about an hour northwest of Johannesburg. It's actually used to train cavers. So it's not a special place. This whole region is littered with these caves, but this is a particularly convoluted one. And Rick and Steve were exploring a passageway that goes about 100 yards into the dark zone. And they'd climbed up a prominence called the Dragon's Back. And at that point, Rick was fiddling around, and Steve backed up into a corner to get a picture of Rick, and his foot just stepped into this hole, and he took another step down into the hole, and then another step, and he found that he was in this extremely narrow passage, just about 8 inches wide, that dropped 40 feet into a cave that had really never been seen before, and there on the floor of this cave were hundreds of bones, and they turned out to be bones of a human relative called, now we know, as Homo Naledi.
So we're going to get to Homo Naledi in just a moment, but I just want to dig into that story a little bit more, no pun intended. This was not a trip for the claustrophobic. 8 inches? And then there's this big drop?
Yeah, and that's after you've gone through another passage before you even get there that's called the Superman's Crawl, because it's so narrow that you've got to put your one arm out in front of you and the other along your side, like the Man of Steel in Flight. So it's a precarious climb, and getting into this tunnel, this little chute, can only be achieved by people who are very thin and very fit and very experienced, and Steve or Rick among those people.
And it's dark, so, too, correct?
Oh, absolutely. It's pitch dark. We're way into the dark zone. So the question became, now they alerted Lee Berger, who's a paleoanthropologist at the University of Witwatersrand, and he had put out a message to cavers, hey, if you find anything, let me know. So they got in touch with him through another caver, and Lee was faced with the conundrum of how do we get these bones out when no one can get into the cave to excavate them.
So you're not going to blast the cave open, obviously.
No, that's a no-no. We're not going to do anything that's going to be an invasive procedure that would change the dynamics of this cave or affect the geology. You have to leave it intact. So Lee came up with the idea of using Facebook to recruit very slender, experienced cavers who are also anthropologists and archaeologists who had some excavation experience.
That must have been an interesting notification.
Yeah, well, I've seen it. It was, you know, wanted, skinny people willing to work in close quarters who have that kind of background. And he got 60 people responded, which he selected six. They were all young women. Women tend to be more slender, and they are all very experienced cavers. And they were the underground astronauts, as Lee puts it, who did the actual excavation.
Jamie, tell us what graduate student Marina Elliott felt when she was looking down that chute and thinking about the journey that was ahead of her.
Well, what you see as you look down, according to Marina, of course, I've never been down there. She said, just like shark's teeth. It's just these prominences of these protruding teeth of rock that you have to work your way around. And I saw Marina when she'd just come out of the cave once in June of 2014. And, you know, her arms and are all scraped up and bloodied. Her legs, she's just used to this kind of very close work with this rock. And that's what you've got to do if you want to get down there.
But for these scientists, it's the adventure of a lifetime.
Oh, my God. Fantastic adventure. I've been talking to Becca Pachotto, who's another one of the cavers recently, and just the way that she reacts when people ask her questions about it, she almost catches her breath with the thought of holding a skull of this creature in this dark cave and being the person who's going to bring it up to the surface. It's a tremendous experience.
Well, tell us about what these women uncovered.
Well, most of the time when you find hominid bones, hominids being members of our human family, in these caves in South Africa, you find them associated with a lot of other stuff, with animal bones, with plant material, with rocks and rubble and debris. In this case, you found none of that. All they found, with the exception of a couple of rat teeth and one little owl bone, was pure hominid bones, every single bone, and there's 1,500 of them. So it's an incredibly unusual sight. First, for having just the sheer quantity of bones. I don't think there's anything like it in Africa that can compare with that. There's only one site anywhere in the world which has that number of bones. That's an early pre-Neanderthal site in Spain. And they've been excavating that site since the 1980s, and they've gotten, you know, dozens of, I don't know, a couple dozen skeletons, pieces of skeletons. But this was all at once, and they have 15 individuals minimum represented.
Were the skeletons intact?
Yeah. No, they weren't intact, but in some cases, their pieces were articulated. So they found a hand with all the bones of the fingers more or less where they would be in life. And that suggests that these bones have not been moved from somewhere else by water action, by geological forces of one kind or another. They pretty much were found where they were first deposited. So that's a clue. Question is, what's the mystery that it's a clue to?
So, and that's what I was going to get to next. What did paleoanthropologist Lee Berger, when he first saw these bones, what did he think? Because he'd never seen anything like them before.
No. And what he first saw were photographs that Rick and Steve had taken when they were down there. And his initial thought was, sorry, we're having a possible fire drill here at the headquarters, but I think it's okay. What he first thought was it was an Australopithecine. It's an already known species that's a precursor to our own Homo genus. But when he got a better look at them, he could see that there was too many traits that were really representative of the genus Homo. So what we have here is a new species of Homo, because some parts of the body are extremely primitive. The shoulder is almost like an ape, and the fingers of the hand are extremely curved, and both of those are clues to an animal that's doing a lot of climbing in trees. But that animal that's climbing in trees is welded to an animal on the bottom half of his anatomy that is clearly adapted to a striding bipedal gait, very much like our own. The foot is practically indistinguishable from a modern human foot.
Hmm.
So it's a strange mosaic, and it does tell us, if anything else, the first sort of take-home message of this find is that there's more than one way of being a human, and this is back in time. There may have been a lot of different experimentations, so to speak, on how to develop a striding bipedal animal like ourselves.
So in different parts of the world, there are different evolutionary processes taking place?
Yeah.
That's a theory?
This anatomy suggests that it's maybe close to the point of the origin of the genus Homo, which would be 2 to 3 million years ago. And at that point, the only place you're going to find these bipeds is in Africa. Now, we don't know if that anatomy is really telling the whole story about how old this is. It's very risky business to judge a fossil's age by what it looks like. You have to find other means of dating the fossil.
How are they going to go about doing that, the scientists?
Well, the typical way of first trying to get an approximate date on fossils in these South African caves is to look at other extinct mammals that the fossils are found in association with. But in this case, of course, there are none. So that's out. Another way of dating fossils is by using a technique called uranium lead dating on flow stones, these kind of calcium deposits in the cave, but they have to be very closely associated with the bones, and in this case, that's not the case either. So we have a situation where they really have to go to some more experimental techniques to find the date for the fossil, which is why they have not yet found one. And they have, and they want to use at least three different kinds of these techniques. There's one called electron spin resonance or paleomagnetism. There's different ways of dating things, and they all have to come up with the same age for it to be credible. So at this point, they're still in the process of getting that that information.
So back to what this being looked like. How tall? How heavy?
The females were about, Becca Pachota, one of the cavers, likes to say, hey, I'm the same size as Homo naledi. She's 4'10". The males were probably in the range of about 5 feet, so that's well within the range of modern human variability, and their weights were the same. I mean, they were smaller and lighter than most humans, in sort of a developed country like the U.S. that you would see, but they are certainly within the range of variation of globally of modern Homo sapiens.
And Jamie, you write that the brain was less than half the size of a modern human's brain, but it's also theorized that the dead of Homo naledi were placed in the cave as a burial ground, and that's a human concept.
Well, this is the big mystery of Mystery Man. This has, like I said, a body is in the range of modern human variability, but on the top of this body is a little pinheaded, tiny brain creature. So, and one that possibly is engaging in what would seem to be an act that requires a certain amount of intentional forethought, which is deliberately disposing of their dead. That's the only way that the team has been able to hypothesize how these bones were getting into the cave, that other Homo naledi were dragging corpses and disposing of them down this chute. They don't like to use the term burial because that suggests ceremony and funerals and an afterlife and such. We don't know anything about that. There's no grave goods that would suggest there was a ceremonial aspect to this burial. So they like to just say disposing of the dead and leave it at that for now. But that in itself would require some very complex cultural mechanisms. Like, I mean, how are you going to get 100 yards into the dark, twisting and turning without some sort of light, which would imply that they had fire, that they were, in fact, managing fire in the form of torches or oil lamps or something. And that's quite complex behavior that we would associate normally with modern human beings and possibly with Neanderthals.
Do we have any idea about what the diet was like of Homo naledi and whether they were able to use this fire to cook their food?
We don't want to get too far ahead. We don't know yet that the evidence of fire is purely circumstantial.
Got
it's
it.
Like, how else could they have gotten down there if they were still alive? We don't have any evidence yet of diet, but it's one of the things that they're very intent on getting. And you can get that kind of evidence from tooth structure, from microwear patterns on the teeth, and even from plaque that you can scrape off of the teeth. It may have what are called phytoliths, which are plant cells that would indicate what kind of plants they might have been eating. So there's lots of information that still is to be gotten from this find. It would take years, really, to work it all out.
So where does Homo naledi stand in relation to other finds, such as Lucy, who was discovered in Ethiopia several decades back? If you could get into that a little bit more for us, that would be great.
Well, Lucy is the quintessential sort of root of the human family tree in the conventional point of view. And this find is, in some ways, even more primitive than Lucy, but in other ways, more modern. And it's also in a different part of Africa. So you'd have to think that, well, we evolved somewhere. I mean, somehow we got from an ape-like precursor to Homo. And one route could be in East Africa through the Australopithecine species known as Afarensis. That's Lucy's species. It could be that we evolved instead in South Africa through a precursor to this species. So it's a question mark. It doesn't necessarily push Lucy off the family tree. It just adds another member of that tree, and we're not sure how to draw the branches and limbs and connect them yet. And again, that's going to be something that's going to require a lot more research.
And Lieberger theorizes that the metaphor for human evolution is actually more like a braided stream than a family tree.
Hello?
Can you hear me, Jamie?
Yeah, I lost you after braided.
We only have about 30 seconds left, but Lieberger theorizes that the metaphor for human evolution is more like a braided stream as opposed to a family tree.
Right. That's an idea that basically populations can evolve and then they can diverge from each other and perhaps for hundreds of thousands or even millions of years, and that they have not yet speciated. They're still, when they come back together, because perhaps there's change in geography or something, they can interbreed again, but they bring traits that have evolved in separate back into that mutual gene pool. So it's sort of like that idea of a stream that has channels that meander away and then come back into the main river.
Fascinating stuff. Jamie Shreve, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Jamie is National Geographic Magazine's executive editor of science and author of the October issue cover story entitled Mystery Man. Hey, don't forget to visit our Facebook page and check out our podcast by heading to our homepage. That's whyy.org/Radio Times. I'm Mary Cummings Jordan, in for Marty Moscowane. Hour 2 is just ahead.